All the best Bitcoin works read aloud so that you can listen. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. Continuing with the efficient market hypothesis thread and extending from yesterday's read, incredibly thorough piece by Nick Carter on breaking down the efficient market hypothesis and how it may apply to Bitcoin. And so if you have not listened to yesterday's, it's a really good prerequisite, I guess you could say, for what we're doing today. And we will start out today with a read by Plan B, the original author of the breaking down the entire stock to flow model of Bitcoin and testing it. He has written an article titled The Efficient Market Hypothesis and the Stock to Flow Model. So let's go ahead and get into the read, and we'll talk a little bit about it afterward. Efficient Market Hypothesis and Bitcoin Stock to Flow Model by Plan B. Introduction. Bitcoin Stock to Flow, or S2F model, was published in March 2019. The model has been well received by Bitcoiners and investors. Many analysts have verified the co-integrated S2F model and confirmed Bitcoin price forecasts. The stock-to-flow model also received critique. The best steel man argument against the model comes from the efficient market hypothesis, or EMH. The argument states that the model is based on publicly available information, stock-to-flow and Bitcoin's supply trajectory, and therefore the analysis and conclusion must be already priced in. In this article, I share my point of view on stock-to-flow model and the efficient market hypothesis. I analyze arbitrage opportunities, risk and return model, and derivatives markets. Stock-to-flow model. Stock-to-flow model was published as a Bitcoin valuation model, inspired by Nick Szabo's concept of unforgeable scarcity and Saifedean-Ammous's analysis of stock-to-flow. Stock-to-flow is a measure of scarcity. The power law relation between stock-to-flow and Bitcoin price over time captures the underlying regularity of Bitcoin's complex, dynamic system of network effects as described by Trace Mayer. The stock-to-flow model is a power law function fitted on October 2009 to February 2019 monthly data. Bitcoin price equals 0.4 times the stock to flow to the third, where stock to flow is 1 divided by the inflation rate. A later model on 2009 to 2019 yearly data has higher forecasts. Bitcoin price is 0.18 times stock to flow to the power 3.3. Nick Fraudsta was the first to verify, or better, not falsify, the stock-to-flow model, and he added co-integration analysis, indicating that the correlation is likely not spurious. Marcel Berger verified both stock-to-flow model and co-integration with several additional statistical tests. Manuel Andersch was the first institutional investor to verify the stock-to-flow model and co-integration. Efficient market hypothesis. EMH is a well-known theory in financial economics. EMH is based on ideas of Friedrich Hayek, the 1974 Nobel Prize, and others. According to Hayek, markets are information processing systems, delivering the best possible price discovery. EMH is formally described by Eugene Fama, the 2013 Nobel Prize, and comes in three flavors. 1. Weak EMH. Historical price data is already priced in and cannot be used to make profits. Technical analysis, or TA, and time series analysis, TSA, do not work. 2. Semi-strong EMH. Public news from media outlets like MSNBC, Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal, and research companies is already priced in and cannot be used to make profits. Fundamental analysis, or FA, does not work. And 3. Strong EMH. Even inside information cannot be used to make a profit because all information is already priced in. Most investors and economists agree that modern financial markets are reasonably efficient. In other words, they accept weak and semi-strong EMH. However, they reject strong EMH. Following EMH, the stock-to-flow model should be priced in because it is based on publicly available data, the stock-to-flow. To be honest, I have never used the efficient market hypothesis directly in my 20-plus years' experience as an institutional investor managing a multi-billion euro balance sheet. In practice, we assume the efficient market hypothesis and use a risk and return model. Assuming the efficient market hypothesis. Some people argue that Bitcoin markets are not efficient, but I do not agree. In the old days, you could buy Bitcoin at one exchange in US dollars and sell it shortly afterwards at another exchange in euro or Japanese yen and convert it back to US dollars at a profit. Arbitrage was possible. Those days are gone, as the table below shows. January 13th of 2020, 2000 Greenwich Mean Time prices. The Bitcoin US dollar price equals 8,100. The Bitcoin euro price equals 7,300. The Bitcoin US dollar divided by the Bitcoin euro equals 1.11. The euro to USD price is 1.11. Bitcoin to Japanese yen price is 885. The Bitcoin Japanese yen divided by the Bitcoin US dollar price equals 109. The US dollar Japanese yen price is 109. Perhaps there is still some money to be made with big computers, fast communication lines, and high-frequency trading algorithms, but there are no easy arbitrage opportunities. We can safely assume that the $150 billion Bitcoin market with $10 billion of daily transactions is reasonably efficient. Risk and return model. Assuming the EMH does not mean that you cannot make money. You just have to take risk. The efficient market hypothesis and non-arbitrage lead us to risk and return models. Harry Markowitz, the 1990 Nobel Prize, introduced an early risk and return model with his famous portfolio theory. William Sharpe, 1990 Nobel Prize, published his well-known capital asset pricing model. According to Markowitz and Sharpe, all returns can be explained by risk. This is a simplified risk and return model without correlation or exotic math. It is crucially important to understand this chart, so let's dive into it. The x-axis of this chart is risk, maximum annual loss, and the y-axis is return, average annual return. The chart shows three classic assets: bonds, gold, and stocks. Bonds have the lowest risk, 8%, and the lowest return, 6%. Gold has higher risk, 33%, and higher return, 7.5%. Stocks have the highest risk at 40% and the highest return at 8%. The key insight is that returns can be explained by risk alone, consistent with the efficient market hypothesis. If you encounter an asset above the line, a first reaction could be that it is a great investment opportunity. A better reaction, from an efficient market hypothesis and non-arbitrage point of view, would be that it is too good to be true. We are probably missing risks or have miscalculated risk and should try to bring the asset back on the line. Quantifying risk or volatility is difficult, and indeed the expertise of quants of financial institutions. If an investor calculates that risks are lower than the market prices in, and if he exactly knows why the asset is above the line, then and only then should he decide to invest. Bitcoin is literally off the chart. 200% return and 80% risk. Because I cannot plot it on the chart, I resized it to a 1% Bitcoin allocation plus 99% cash investment. This Bitcoin investment is far above the line. 8% return, 1% risk. Note that you can't lose more than 1%, even if Bitcoin drops 99%, because you only invest 1%. So my first reaction is, the market sees risks that are not in the data. Here is a list of some possible risks. Risk that Bitcoin dies. Risk of governments making Bitcoin illegal and prosecuting developers. Risk of fatal software bugs. Risk of exchange hacks. Risk of 51% attacks by centralized miners. Risk of miner death spiral after halving. Risk of hard forks. From an efficient market hypothesis and risk and return perspective, all these risks should be in the price data. But these risks are not in the data. According to the efficient market hypothesis and the risk and return formula in the chart, 1% risk should give 5.5% plus 6.2% times 1% equals a 5.6% return. And the data shows that 1% Bitcoin allocation plus 99% cash had 8% return for the last 11 years. It seems that these risks have been overestimated by the market, and that Bitcoin really was a great investment opportunity, in line with the stock-to-flow model. Derivatives markets. Let's look at what derivatives markets are telling us about the future. Option markets show no spike at or after the next halving. Same story for the futures market. Slightly higher prices in the future, but no spike at or after the halving, indicating nothing special will happen at the halving. This is interesting because the stock-to-flow model forecasts much higher prices after the halving. How should we interpret this? I think the simple answer is that the market currently overestimates future risk, like it overestimated risk for the past 11 years. The efficient Bitcoin market not only discounts the fundamental value of scarcity, the stock-to-flow model, but also these risks. 42% of investors see Bitcoin futures as the biggest risk, whales and governments manipulating the price of Bitcoin with paper Bitcoin, spoofing, and wash trades. 16% still fears miner capitulation after the halving. 15% fear selling pressure from scams. I know from discussions with institutional investors that their biggest fear is government making Bitcoin illegal. Another risk frequently mentioned by institutional investors is the next Bitcoin, a new government or central bank-backed coin replacing Bitcoin. Note that without all of these risks, Bitcoin's value would be much higher, possibly in line with the stock-to-flow model. As time progresses, some of these risks will not materialize and disappear from the list. Take miner capitulation, for example. I do not think miner capitulation is a big risk, but 15% of investors thinks it is. If hash rate does not decrease after the next halving, the risk of miner capitulation disappears, and Bitcoin price will rise because the risk is gone. Conclusion. The Bitcoin stock-to-flow model was introduced in March 2019 and verified by many others. The efficient market hypothesis implies that the stock-to-flow and the model forecasts should be already priced in by the market because the stock-to-flow model uses publicly available stock-to-flow data. Current Bitcoin markets are indeed reasonably efficient because easy arbitrage opportunities are not possible. Historical risk and return data of bonds, gold, stocks, and Bitcoin shows that Bitcoin markets overestimated risk. Bitcoin return was not in line with risk, but very much in line with the stock-to-flow model. Bitcoin options and futures markets do not expect rising prices at or after the next halving. It is possible that markets still overestimate future risks. My conclusion is that Bitcoin markets are indeed reasonably efficient and price in the stock-to-flow model, but also overestimate the risk. Therefore, I prefer using the stock-to-flow model over a classic risk and return model to forecast the future Bitcoin price. So I assume the efficient market hypothesis, and I would definitely pick up that Bitcoin. And that concludes our article by Plan B, the efficient market hypothesis and the Bitcoin stock-to-flow model. And let's go ahead and hit our sponsor, and then I'll kind of break down some of the concepts and explain some of the things that were a little bit hard to follow, I'm sure, in audio. So there are a lot of actual different elements and I think concerns that Nick Carter maybe assumes away in the previous article in the Efficient Market Hypothesis. And I really like how this article frames something that I think is absolutely a huge factor in the market determining the price of Bitcoin, and most importantly, anticipating future events, is the perceived very, very high risk of being involved in Bitcoin. And I think that discounts any attempt to basically find post-halving prices actually displayed in the price of Bitcoin very at a long time distance between, before that event actually occurs. And most of it comes from just incredible uncertainty. I think there are a lot of other factors at play that I want to get into tomorrow, but I just like how Plan B labels this positions this all as a measure of risk versus return. And one of the best lines in this whole piece, let me find it so I get it exactly right. Let me go ahead and start talking about the chart here. So for anybody who hasn't gone and looked at the chart is really simple. There's a linear, literally just a line relationship between the likely risks and return of certain assets. And in this graph, all he shows is S&P 500, gold, treasury bonds, and then a 1% allocation into Bitcoin. But basically showing that there's a model to measure these things and the likelihood of accuracy and reasonable return available to them. And in doing so, you can basically assess the realistic investments against this line, that you would expect things to fall on this line, that if you were going to get so-and-so high return, well, then you would expect roughly this amount of risk involved. And an investor can use this to assess whether or not this is a investment that should go against them or something that's a really good opportunity to invest in. It's got a quote from that. So a quote, if an investor calculates that risks are lower than the market prices in, and if he exactly knows why the asset is above the line, then and only then should he decide to invest. The earlier in that same paragraph, the key insight is that returns can be explained by risk alone, consistent with the efficient market hypothesis. If you encounter an asset above the line, a first reaction could be that it's a great investment opportunity. A better reaction from an efficient market hypothesis and non-arbitrage point of view would be that it is too good to be true. And when talking about Bitcoin, it's literally quote-unquote off the chart. It's a 200% return annual with an 80% risk. Being able to soberly assess something that has such ridiculous returns, like, I think this is a huge play into why the market is essentially ignoring the future of this stock to flow. I do want to get into some other things, particularly questions about if this is the efficient market hypothesis and this is all priced in. I think we could then, we should also see a great many other things that I don't think we see. Something that I find very, very unlikely. And because of that, it's why I don't think the real supply schedule, the end result of what Bitcoin is going to be in 5, 10, 15 years as far as hard money goes, is not even remotely priced in. And I don't think it's just a factor of demand, even though demand really is what drives it. I think demand will be a consequence of essentially playing out the story that this is true, that this is actually going to happen. Because I believe there is a lot of risk in I think there's a very small market that actually thinks it will, and confidently thinks that Bitcoin has a real staying power, that has a very bright and long future ahead of it. I love this little list. Really great. These hit some of the main things that I actually wrote down when thinking about this, because I think really the difference between what the stock to flow should estimate the price at, if we're using just a supply model here, versus what the actual market is pricing it, I think it's all a time discount because of the incredible uncertainty, specifically in an asset, money, that is all about hedging against uncertainty. Again, I'll go a little bit more into that tomorrow's episode, but I think that's a big factor, is that money is a tool to hedge against uncertainty. So when you have an enormous amount of uncertainty in the money, I think it throws in a degree of arbitrariness, like inconsistency or unreliability in supposed known information. I think it makes the known information unknown. I think it makes them basically a roll of the dice at the craps table, and that pulls a very different price than something where you know what the outcome is. And I think that's what Nick Carter is missing, or I guess in assuming in his argument for the efficient market hypothesis and that stock to flow is priced in, is that because it's known information, that it's known, hands down, no questions asked, going to happen information. I think it is an unknown in the market. I truly think that the vast majority of the money coming in see it as a question mark as to whether or not the stock to flow is going to play out, and whether or not this thing is going to be here when that inflation schedule changes. And there's a lot of factors in that, and I'm trying to get my head around like a list of them to try to break down why I feel that way. But I like a Plan B's list is great here. The risk that Bitcoin dies. Boom. Absolute huge giant unknown that I think the vast majority of the market is like, probably, but yeah, we don't know. I mean, we still celebrate Bitcoin's birthday and boast, and how many people on Twitter, how many real hedge fund managers and people with lots of capital to move. Peter Schiff is a great example. Immediately discount it. Think it's an absolute joke. Think it's funny money. I don't think the mentality, and even if we're talking about, I don't think there are major price setters that have any degree of confidence to the tune of the billions of dollars it would need to find a price that accounts for the realistic monetary schedule of Bitcoin. That this is actually set in stone, and that this is going to be the future of the Bitcoin protocol. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. Risk that Bitcoin dies, risk of governments making Bitcoin illegal and prosecuting developers, huge thing that needs to be factored in, risk of fatal software bugs, risk of exchange hacks, risk of 51% attacks by centralized miners, risk of minor death spiral after the halving, and risk of hard forks. And I also think a huge part of this is risk of actually holding your coins. We're not used to having to rely so heavily on an uneditable piece of software. We're used to being able to edit. None of our infrastructure is ready to take on the level of risk of holding hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars worth of Bitcoin. And I think that's arbitrary irrelevant to the amount of liquidity and amount of money there to invest, because just because they think that Bitcoin has a very solid solid future, and that they know that this inflation schedule is going to get cut in half, that doesn't mean that they're ready and can very easily put $1 billion into Bitcoin, regardless of the liquidity, if they don't know if they can hold it, if they can insure it safely, and if whoever they have hold it for them can actually do so in a trustworthy manner. Like, there's huge risk in putting, there's risk in putting thousands of dollars into Bitcoin, particularly if you're trying to hold your own keys. If you're talking about billions of dollars, I think there is a lot that is still up in the air, and the companies that have made that avenue available to the market still have not, I don't think they've proven their worth. I don't think they're that trustworthy yet. Bakkt is still getting off the ground. It continues to grow in volume, and look what their opening was. Their opening was nothing. It was like, I think it was like 2 Bitcoins worth of contracts were traded in the first couple of days. Like, it was incredibly small volume because everybody feels like they're walking on thin ice. And it's an entirely new asset class that has a monumental amount of risk, or at least that's what I think most people see it as. And just going by the volatility, you've got incredible risk. And when you start looking at the return and you try to put this, as Plan B has done, on the risk return model, it looks ridiculous. It looks completely too good to be true. So immediately, again, the kind of the maturity and the mental framing of the market is not ready to absorb something like that. Something that just makes all of their other stuff look stupid and makes, you know, puts all their charts, makes the zoom on all their charts, make everything else invisible. It just, I don't think the market is confident enough to handle it yet. And I think that's a huge part of why I think it is an example of the efficient and of the efficient market hypothesis. And Plan B makes this argument that no, this is, I think this is why it follows the stock to flow. Why it is following the stock to flow is because of the accounting for risk, because of the discount of the amount of time it takes for us to get to this supposed future and the giant list of unknowns that could basically get in the way of this. And maybe I'm oversimplifying something. Maybe I'm actually really discounting the professionalism and kind of the sentiment in the broader market, in the larger financial markets. But I'm not very close to, I don't work in that market. I don't talk to, you know, OTC traders and stuff like that, any amount of money moving in and out. But I think I would bet, if I had a little bit of money that I could bet on this, I would bet that sentiment is very, very low in regards to whether or not Bitcoin has the staying power to make a multi-year investment in it, like a flat investment in it. And I would bet that most of the money that is confident is already in Bitcoin. Or in fact, most of the money that is confident about it was probably made in Bitcoin, and therefore there's no extra buying pressure there because it's already held in Bitcoin. But maybe I have a completely ignorant view of the financial markets, but I still think there are other factors involved, and I really want to get into those tomorrow. So I think I'm going to lay out a guy's take episode, which will kind of hit these points again, but I want to go a little bit in depth and kind of reference a number of pieces we've read in the past that I think lead credence to my argument, at least give a foundation to actually set this narrative from. So we will do that tomorrow. A huge thank you to Plan B, or at 100 trillion USD, if you're not following it on Twitter or Medium. So much great stuff, and you don't want to miss, no matter what. I think a key takeaway from all of this and from reading Plan B and all of this stuff and the arguments for and the arguments against and the incredible fit that model has, if you haven't read it yet, there's another part where he breaks down and goes through it again, or maybe someone else did it, where they only took this model up to 2012, I believe it was. It was only a handful of years, and then projected it out into the future to see, okay, let's assume that we don't have any data. What would 2012 data predict the future to be? And did that future, since we have that future now, did that line up with it? That is an incredibly good fit. And I think the stock to flow ratio is not something to be ignored. The stock to flow model is a powerful tool at our disposal to think about this. And the incredible fit of that model to what we have seen should not just be outright dismissed. We should continue to look very closely at this and watch what happens as this plays out. What happens when we get to the halving? What happens when we have, you know, some of these risks fall away? Really good example I like that Plan B did was the risk of, are we going to have minor capitulation? Is there going to be a huge drop off in network hash power? Are we going to go into a death spiral? Like, what's going to happen? And if that doesn't happen after the halving, what's the new price of this asset with that risk removed from the marketplace? And I think regardless of what narrative we come up with for why, I find it very hard to believe, and Nick Carter says this, I'm not even really arguing with Nick Carter here because he makes the exact same argument, that after the halving, we make it through the halving, that we should, I think there are many, many different reasons why we should expect a significant price increase and increased amount of value flowing and integrating with the Bitcoin system. So, maybe we'll come up with a good model as to why that is. Maybe stock to flow is it. Maybe there's something entirely different and stock to flow is irrelevant and just a really powerful coincidence. But I guess maybe time will tell us. So with that, again, thank you. Do not forget to follow Plan B or at 100 trillion USD on Twitter and on Medium. Drop some massive applause on this article. I've always loved 100 trillion USD stuff. Got really great analysis. And another huge thank you to Nick Carter, and do the same. I love it. I love it when they hit like an idea like this and kind of go back and forth, because particularly with something that I don't really have worked out myself, it gives me an opportunity to play around with these ideas and think about it for myself. And I love that. So thank you to both of those guys. Do not forget to follow both of them. Drop some massive applause on both of these, and we will be back here tomorrow with another episode. I am the Crypto at the Crypto Economy on Twitter. Do not forget to follow me, Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we will be back with another fun discussion all about these ideas. Thank you so much for listening. I love you all. Take it easy, guys. We'll be right back.